Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Dr. Nicholas Money, Western Program Director and Professor of Botany at Miami University in Ohio. Dr. Money earned his PhD from the University of Exeter in England. He's a leading expert on fungus and mold and the author of several scientific books and articles, including his most recent work, Mushroom. His other books include The Triumph of the Fungi, A Rotten History, and Carpet Monsters and Killer Spores, A Natural History of Toxic Mold. Dr. Money is also a writer of fiction. Dr. Nicholas Money, thank you so much for joining us. This is fascinating. Tell me something to begin with, because our listeners want to know. We get a lot of telephone calls about this. How dangerous is all of this stuff, the mold, for example, and what is it?
Well, if we're talking about molds and in particular fungi that proliferate in the indoor environment in our homes, the short answer is that these microorganisms are not as dangerous as some sources would have us believe. I think that in the majority of cases, the dangers posed by mold have been overhyped. So I guess that's the good news.
And the bad news?
So the bad news is that mold spores actually are very, very potent allergens. And for any of us that are sensitive to the proteins, the allergens carried on the surface of mold spores, indeed, we can be made to feel pretty unhappy in a mold-contaminated environment. And asthma is obviously a very serious problem, a very serious issue of a public health issue. The numbers of asthma cases are increasing, it seems, every year, particularly among children, and molds are probably the dominant cause of allergic symptoms globally.
And how does it work? I mean, if you have asthma, how does it work that the mold creates the symptom?
Well, there's the simple answer to that would be that in cases of allergic rhinitis and asthma, that when the mold spores actually interact with the wet surfaces in our breathing system, in our noses and airways, in our lungs, that actually they can cause the release of histamines, that they can interact with cells called mast cells and actually cause this kind of explosive event that then results in the irritation of the airways.
Are there some places that it's better to live to avoid this than others? For example, I grew up on a beach where the people who had asthma and other things used to come, and then people started planting things and screwing up the beach. You know,
there is something to that. It's interesting. In my own case, I was actually highly asthmatic as a child growing up in southern England, in Oxfordshire. But actually moving to the United States more than a quarter of a century ago, I've actually have not been, you know, a terrible asthmatic here. Things have been actually a lot better for me. And the only explanation, I suppose, might be that by moving across the Atlantic, I've actually escaped the allergens that plagued me as a child, that I was sensitized during my infancy to certain kinds of spores and also plant pollen in my environment in Britain. And thankfully, at least so far here, I've escaped these proteins.
With asthma, we always wonder about, you know, psychological motivation also. It's possible you wanted to be in the United States and not in England.
Well, that may well be true. In fact, it is true, but I don't think that there's any the evidence for a psychiatric component in asthma is lacking.
I gotcha. Okay, so now, as kids, we used to yell at each other, there's a fungus among us. What is a fungus?
What is a fungus? Wow. Well, a fungus is lots and lots of different things. There's probably as many as 1.5 million different species of fungi, and only a minority of those actually form anything recognizable as a mushroom. So the vast majority of the fungi are these microscopic organisms that never manifest themselves in anything as large as a mushroom. And these are organisms that are everywhere. They're in, you know, every pinch of soil contains perhaps hundreds of thousands of fungal particles. Mushrooms grow on all plant surfaces. They teem on the surfaces of our bodies. They grow on our scalp. They grow everywhere.
They grow between our toes, don't they?
They certainly grow between our toes in the form of athlete's foot. That's certainly the case.
How much of it is dangerous? I know we can eat a mushroom and die, right?
So, well, there's two answers to that, really. So certainly there are a few toxic mushrooms, and if we're unfortunate enough or silly enough to eat them, then yes, that can be terminate us. But fungi too. I mean, there are a number of microscopic fungi that cause infections. They can bury themselves deep into our tissues and really proliferate throughout most of the organs in our bodies. Thankfully, those kinds of infections only occur, or usually occur, when the immune system is severely compromised. But we face a future where, there are modern medical technologies that are going to be reducing our immune defenses, for example, certain kinds of cancer therapy, and so there's going to be an increasing population of individuals that actually are at risk of really contracting these kinds of life-threatening infections.
You mentioned the C word, and I'm wondering, what any of these fungi or molds have to do with cancer?
Well, nothing directly, but it's the sorts of cancer therapies that we use, including certain kinds of chemotherapy, but more particularly radiotherapy. These are actions that do indeed impair our immune systems, and then we become, I mean, we've been described as sort of living petri dishes. So this is unfortunately the future that a number of us will face.
When you mention radiotherapies, are we talking about radiology? What are we talking about here?
Yeah, radiation therapy then, to actually destroy cancer cells. This is something that unfortunately can take out a good chunk of our immune defenses. And so this just leaves us open to attack from these fungi that are in our environment. And as I said, fungi are everywhere. We're inhaling fungal spores with every breath that we take. And so there's no shortage of these potentially pernicious organisms.
And where do these pernicious organisms, I like it, where do they rest in our bodies? Do they rest in our noses? Do they rest in our cavities? I mean,
well, so I'm speaking to you now from Cincinnati. So we're in the Ohio Valley, and there's a particular fungus here that causes an illness called Ohio Valley disease. And pretty much anyone that lives in this area for more than a few months will actually encounter this fungus. And this will actually be present as a growth within our lungs. And the immune system really takes care of this organism very, very swiftly. And most people are not even aware that they've actually encountered this particular microbe. And it's only in cases when the immune system is severely compromised that this presents in the form of a more apparent or obvious infection.
So when we hear, you know, advertisements or read them saying, you know, these can really be very harmful to you, often it's super hype and you're not as concerned as some would appear to be.
Well, I think that's the case certainly in terms, I mean, 10, 15 years ago, there was a lot of interest in toxic black mold in buildings. And
right.
There's still actually a lot of unanswered questions about what happened in particular cases. And that was actually, there were some highly publicized cases in Cleveland, Ohio in the 1990s of infants that suffered from lung bleeding. And indeed, some of the, a couple of the babies actually died as a result, apparently, of these symptoms. This was called pulmonary hemorrhage.
And do we know that the mold and the outcomes in the case of these children had anything to do with each other?
Well, so there are certainly some very reputable clinicians that still believe to this day that fungi had actually caused this lung bleeding. That again, molds within the homes where these infants were living. But the jury's still out. It's really unclear. There's no proven causal link between exposure to these microorganisms and or one microorganism in particular, this fungus called Stachybotrys, and the awful outcome for these individuals, these families. So this has to play out. Eventually, we'll have an authoritative answer to this question, perhaps. But in the vast majority of cases, and I think most doctors would agree with this, fungal spores can exacerbate allergic symptoms. So I talked about allergic rhinitis and asthma, other issues too. But beyond that, in terms of long-lasting lung damage, for example, this is unclear.
So, Dr. Money, when we move into a house, and what should we look for that looks like black mold? I mean, what does it look like?
I think you've said it, black mold. I don't know.
Really?
It perhaps in extreme cases, I've been into homes that nobody should be living in, perhaps. And the walls and ceilings are blackened by these perhaps dime-sized, quarter-sized fungal colonies. But when you see thousands, hundreds of thousands of these in a property, this might be a home that you don't choose to purchase.
If you want remediation, what are the remediations that are available to get rid of this stuff?
Well, it depends upon the extent of the fungal growth. I mean, in most cases, and you can find fungi in every home. I'm sure we could go into Bill Gates' compound and we could find fungi growing in his bathrooms quite swiftly. They're everywhere. But the issue is the extent of the mold growth. And if you're really just dealing with patches of mold, this is something that the homeowner can deal with really very readily. And there's some great products on the market that can be used to clean those surfaces, or you can do this more cost-effectively just with a 10% solution of Clorox and just actually wiping that surface and removing the mold. The more complicated issue, or we face a more complicated issue when the mold growth is really covering much larger areas. And in that case, it could be that the gypsum board in those areas needs to be removed and replaced. But the issue is always one of moisture, and often a plumbing leak or a roof leak. And unless you actually get that fixed, the mold's going to be back. Again, the spores are everywhere in the environment. And so if they've got a food source and they've got moisture, they're going to grow.
So the chances of having mold in your house are exacerbated when it's in the bathroom or in the roof.
Yeah, wherever there's moisture, it's very likely that one's going to encounter microscopic fungi or molds.
Let's talk a little bit more about mushrooms. Everybody has some mushrooms on their land, or many people do. How do they get there? I mean, what makes a mushroom grow? I'm always astounded when I see them.
Yeah, there is this sort of, there's this magic to them, magic to their appearance, or apparent magic to their appearance. But mushrooms are really just the above ground expressions of colonies of fungi, microorganisms that are growing in the soil and or proliferating through rotting wood. And these colonies, when they've generated enough biomass, when they've engaged in enough feeding and under appropriate conditions, they reproduce. And the sex organ produced by these colonies then is the mushroom. And the mushroom is a wondrous device for the production and release of microscopic spores. So it's a crucial part in the life cycle of these organisms.
I'm not sure I understand it when you say sex organ. Sometimes they look like sex organs, but what do you mean?
Yeah, they certainly do. But from the fungal perspective, then usually what happens is two different strains of these of the same species come together, and their colonies fuse. This is invisible to us, to the observer, the above ground observer. But they fuse, and then they produce a mushroom that then represents the fruit of this mating activity. And there's recombination of genes from these two partners, just as there is in our life cycle. And then the mushroom actually expels its offspring in the form of these microscopic spores.
Dr. Nicholas Money is a program director and professor of botany at Miami University, one of the leading experts in the world on this, I would say. So why, if these things come from, you know, stuff that grows in the dirt, I guess all vegetables do and others do, are we so fascinated with them? And which varieties are the ones that, A, kill you, and which are the ones that are really valuable, and if you find them, you're really special?
Well, I suppose beauty's in the eye of the beholder, so I like looking at all of them rather than interested in eating them.
Oh, even the killers.
Oh, they're wonderful things to behold.
What do the killers look like? What do some of those mushrooms look like? I know we're
on
the radio.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, it's a minority of mushroom species that can really do us any significant damage, and they don't look really any different from the edible mushrooms. Or rather, we can certainly discriminate between different species. And if you're with a competent mushroom expert, somebody that can really tell these things apart, there really isn't any problem. But there are no broad rules for discriminating between toxic and edible mushrooms. You know, many of these things have this classic umbrella form, and it's really impossible to tell just by glancing at them whether this thing is something that's going to be a delight to consume or will actually destroy you.
How about the animals, you know, the squirrels and the crows? And do they know which ones are the good ones and which ones are the bad ones?
Yeah, that's a good question. But there are certainly examples of mushrooms that are very toxic for us, and yet we see a variety of different non-human animal species browsing on these fruit bodies. So if just observing that a slug or a snail has eaten a particular mushroom cap isn't a guide to its edibility, human edibility.
When do these appear? I mean, when do we find them?
Well, there are mushrooms that will fruit throughout most of the year. There are even some mushrooms that will fruit in winter. Now, they actually need a few mild days to actually produce the fruit body, and then there are these a handful of species that can survive actually full freezing, and then they can thaw and then get on with the job of releasing spores. So providing moisture is available and the temperature is conducive to their development, mushrooms can be found throughout the year. But there are specific kinds of edible mushroom that have particular seasons. And so in my part of the world, in the Midwest, we're in the middle of the morel fruiting right now. So these are prized edible mushrooms, and those fruit between toward the end of April and through the beginning of May.
Now, Dr. Money, some of these mushrooms are used in medicines, aren't they?
So there's a lot of interest in the use of mushrooms as a source of natural medicines. And all kinds of claims have been made about the clinical efficacy of these mushrooms, or rather dried extracts prepared from mushrooms. It seems, however, that there have been relatively few reliable trials that have been conducted to really determine the utility of these compounds. And so a lot of the claims are really unsubstantiated. So it's certainly quite possible that some of these mushrooms extracts are very effective at treating our ills. But the evidence there, the scientific evidence, is lacking in the vast majority of cases.
So if the layperson is confronted by somebody claiming that mushrooms are part of a medicine that is being offered, we should look at the offer with a little bit of hesitation?
I would say so. As I say, the majority of the claims are not claims that can be substantiated. And so you'll certainly find people and many of us, perhaps our friends or colleagues, who swear by particular mushrooms. I mean, but this is, or their the way that they've been helped by consuming mushroom extracts. But these are anecdotal reports rather than something that we can rely upon. I suppose I often think about this, and if you think about prescription medicines, and certainly most prescription medicines have potential side effects, but at least there's someone that we can go after if we're truly damaged by these products.
Or your relatives can, yeah.
Or your relatives can, yes. But at least that's the case with mushroom extracts. I mean, who do you... there's little legal recourse if they're not effective, or indeed you are actually damaged by them.
So you wrote this really scary book called The Triumph of the Fungi. Then, you know, using terms like a rotten history and carpet monsters and killer spores. That all sounds very scary.
Well, many of our interactions with fungi have actually been negative in human history. If we look at the way we grow our crops and our insistence on monoculture agriculture, there are fungal pathogens that have come through and devastated crops and really changed the course of human history.
So where's an example of that?
So, I mean, a good example of that is actually if you think about potato blight, for example.
Uh-huh.
Now, that's caused by not actually something that's classified within kingdom fungi. It's a fungus-like microorganism. So it looks a lot like a fungus and behaves a lot like a fungus, but actually it's more closely related to photosynthetic organisms like diatoms and brown algae, kelps. But the organism anyway that caused this is a thing called Phytophthora, and this came through Northern Europe and spread to Ireland in the 19th century, middle of the 19th century, and famously then caused the deaths of maybe as many as a million Irish peasants, and led to the emigration of maybe another million Irish citizens to our shores.
How was that resolved in the case of the Irish? I was just in Ireland, great place, a lot of people.
I think through death and emigration.
But the spores were still there, weren't they?
So that's right. So over time, it's really interesting actually. So before the potato blight, the population in Ireland had actually risen to about 8 million people. And today, even with population growth in this Catholic country, the population of Ireland today still sits well below that number, something above 6 million people. So you can actually still see the effects of the potato famine today, that the population still hasn't rebounded.
But can you still eat a potato in Ireland?
So, yeah, so absolutely. So with modern fungicides, yes, we can actually absolutely. There are very potent remedies for potato blight. I mean, this is still a microorganism that's seen. It's seen in this country too. There have been outbreaks of potato blight in upstate New York in potato growing areas. But in most cases, there are fungicides that can be used to combat these problems. Although, having said that, actually there are cases of fungicide resistant strains of the potato blight. Mm.
So the Ireland instance is fascinating. You got another?
So another one would be the chestnut blight, which is something in kingdom fungi. So this is a microorganism that swept across the United States in the beginning in the late 19th century and throughout the first half of the 20th century and just decimated the chestnut. And one can regard the chestnut, at least as a forest tree, as functionally extinct. So you can still find chestnut sprouts in many places, but they get knocked back by the fungus very swiftly. These never grow into the kind of magnificent forest trees that were present in the 19th century.
Do we have anything, as in the question of the potato, that can meet the chestnut problem?
To treat a tree so that it doesn't fall victim to the chestnut blight fungus, it requires sort of constant husbandry. And so there are techniques that can be used to infuse the tree with fungicide to prevent or at least stem the growth of the fungus. Parts of the infected tree can be pruned away, but this really isn't very, very effective. There's been a little bit more success in dealing with Dutch elm disease. So that's another of these epidemic fungal diseases that swept across the country. And in Washington, D.C., on the Mall, there are American elm trees there that are in very good shape. But if you look at them, each of those trees has a tag on it, and there's a very particular spraying and injection schedule that's used to actually keep the fungus at bay. And if they quit doing that, if they quit infusing fungicide into these trees, they'd succumb to Dutch elm disease very swiftly.
We're talking to Dr. Nicholas Money, Weston Program Director and Professor of Botany at Miami University in Ohio. Okay, so I walk down the streets of New York, and there's always somebody selling chestnuts. Is it possible that if you ingest this stuff, you're ingesting the fungi or whatever else is infecting?
No, I mean, there's no problem there. And the chestnuts that are sold in New York and elsewhere, many of those actually come from, or most of them actually come from producers overseas from China, but there are also some producers in Europe.
Well, how did they avoid there is, it?
Well, so here's the deal. Those are not American chestnut trees, and it turns out that the American chestnut is particularly susceptible to this fungus. In terms of its evolutionary history, the chestnut blight fungus probably evolved in Japan. And what we find in Asia is that the chestnut species in that part of the world tend to show greater resistance to the chestnut blight pathogen. And whereas here, the American chestnut species is exceedingly susceptible to infection by this fungus. Now, there are some there are actually some farms in on the East Coast that actually use hybrid chestnuts, and they've had a great deal of success there, and indeed they can actually produce crops of chestnuts that are apparently very good to eat.
So you anticipated my question, which is obviously if American chestnuts are the problem, then you start to import chestnuts from China.
Yeah, so I don't think there's any particular problem in actually, you know, maintaining a supply of chestnuts for sure. The American market. But the thing is that the trees that used to grow in our forests in the United States in the 19th century and before the 19th century, I mean, these were enormous trees. They were referred to as the redwoods of the East. And these were unimaginably, perhaps, beautiful forests. And those are gone, and we're not going to ever see those kinds of trees again.
So let's talk a little bit more about the magic of mushrooms. I hear that some very famous people have been involved in mushroom getting. Is that right?
I mean, one of the people that interests me most with respect to mushroom collecting and mushroom eating was a Civil War veteran called Captain Charles McIlvaine. And he wrote a book, it was published in 1900, called 1,000 American Fungi. And this gentleman, possibly as a result of what we call PTSD today, so after the Civil War, he traveled around the eastern United States, particularly in West Virginia, on horseback. And he had this epiphany one day from the saddle, which was that he was surrounded in the woods by food for free. That there were all these mushrooms that could be harvested and serve as a nutritious meal for the hundreds of thousands of people displaced by the Civil War. And so he started began this odyssey through the forest, collecting and testing the edibility of every single fungus that he collected. And he became known as Old Iron Guts because he tested a lot of things that are rather unpleasant and some things that were probably highly toxic. But he managed to survive. In this book, then 1,000 American Fungi, he describes the delectable fungi that he consumed, but he also describes the violent intestinal distress that he endured as a result of eating other species.
So, but we don't know if other famous Americans, Abraham Lincoln or George Washington or people like that, went out looking for mushrooms.
I doubt that they did. That I think what's, Charles McIlvaine really introduced the hobby of mushroom collecting to a wider audience. And I don't know, I'd have a, be fascinating, wouldn't it? I have a tough time imagining Thomas Jefferson going out and collecting and eating mushrooms to accompany his fine wines.
Is there anything you can learn from botany that teaches us about not only, you know, botanical things, but things that human beings, can we learn anything from spores, fungi, mushrooms? Is there anything that we could about human behavior?
Oh, many, many things. I mean, one thing is, I think that a study of mushrooms, a study of fungi, a study of other organisms really helps us to perhaps recalibrate and see ourselves as a part of and really a rather insignificant part of much wider biological diversity. And I think what I've learned over the many years of studying mushrooms or what I'm contemplating now is just how little we matter in the great scheme of things, even though it seems as if we're hell-bent on removing most of biological diversity from the planet before we exit. In fact, most of the information on the planet, most of the natural information, biological information, is not expressed in any form that's identifiable as well, even as an animal. That we're a rather minor part of things.
Speaking of minor parts, does this get you to think, as I just listened to you, that we may be very minor, that we may have, you know, I mean, I've always been one who believes that if the universe is as great as I think it is, there's got to be something else out there, and we may be the mushrooms and the spores.
I suppose that's possible, yes. That, yeah, I probably...
Well, as a scientist, what do you really believe? You believe as a scientist that we're it?
Oh, no, I've got very little respect for our species. You know, I'm not looking forward to my expiration, but on the other hand, I kind of welcome the idea that once I'm gone, that I'll be digested by fungi in the soil. That sounds like a rather glorious end.
Well, I'm not talking about the fungi necessarily. I'm thinking, how about what else is out there in the great
elsewhere in the universe?
Yes.
Oh, I think it's very likely that life exists elsewhere. I mean, that, or rather, has done at some particular time. The space is very, very big and very, very old, and it's inconceivable to me that life hasn't evolved on planets where the conditions perhaps are similar to those on Earth. So I think that's likely, but I also think it's very unlikely that we're ever going to encounter other organisms with which we can communicate.
My view on that is we better hope not, because they may eat us.
I think that's right. Yeah, that's true. Stephen Hawking has said that, famous British physicist. Yes. Okay.
So when we have looked at the stars, when we've looked at moon samples we've retrieved, when we look at Mars, do we think there are spores in these soils?
Well, there's really no evidence of that at this point. It's a very interesting inquiry, though, that in the future we might perhaps find traces of other organisms or organisms that have existed on other planets, even within our solar system. This certainly seems possible.
Are you glad you chose botany as your life's work?
Yes, I have no regrets. I can't think of a better way of spending one's adult life, but in living in contemplation, daily contemplation of nature.
The Brits versus the Americans. Do you suspect more sensitive to the study of botany and to plants than the Americans are? Or is it an invidious comparison?
Yeah, I don't think there's any inherent difference or cultural difference there. I mean, it's certainly among my students, I find... I've actually been very impressed in recent years, actually, by how many young people I've had in my classes that have a real genuine interest in the natural world. Of course, I would wish that perhaps even more students would be turned on by biology. But I don't see any sort of inherent difference between the United Kingdom and the United States in that respect.
Have you been back to lecture in England?
Many times. So, yes, I've returned to Britain many times. But, you know, I've lived here now for more than half of my life and for most of my adult life. And so even though the accent may not convey this, I'm very fully American.
How would you compare the students in your classroom at Miami University in Ohio, a very good, fine school, with those that you encounter in England?
Again, I don't see any huge differences there. This isn't something that, I don't. I mean, the educational systems are certainly very, very, very different.
How so?
I think in some ways, British students, by the time they get to 18, and for those that go to college at 18, 19 years old, they're probably better prepared to study within their major, within their area of expertise. So certainly you see that among biology students in Britain, actually elsewhere in Europe too, versus the United States. But on the other hand, I've got a lot of time for the very broad undergraduate experience in this country, in giving students a real grounding in the liberal arts. And in some ways, I think American students, at least the best of them, are sort of more well-rounded individuals than perhaps those that graduate from British universities.
You know, I was a professor all my life, too, but I sometimes, when speaking with Americans or speaking with British students, have a sense that Americans have a bit of an inferiority complex when it comes to all of this.
I think I would agree with that. I think a number of the American students that I I meet and I talk to perhaps before they go to Europe, that there is some level of intimidation there. But actually, I think it works in the other way. These are very broad brushstrokes here.
Sure.
But I think a lot of British people are very, very impressed by the apparent self-confidence that they read in the youth of America.
Interesting.
I've often heard that said. So
interesting. But as a botanist, as a biologist, I'm interested in the character of the British student versus the character of the American student. I mean, what do you think? I mean, are Americans more alike, or are the Brits more likely to be like each other?
Wow. You know, I don't see much evidence of this either. I mean, increasingly, despite the dreams of some Republicans, I mean, we are becoming a much more diverse country.
This country.
Now, yeah, absolutely.
What about in Great Britain? There is some in-migration, but you're more likely to see people who look and sound like each other, are you not?
Well, it depends where you go. I mean, if you visit London today, sure. I mean, it's an incredibly cosmopolitan city with
sure.
People from all around the world. And so I'm not sure.
You know, my experience has been, Professor Money, that when you walk into a store in Great Britain, you can see people in outlandish garb looking much like students here. But boy, you have a sense that these are better educated and better, people to do business, count change, talk to you.
I don't know. I think that... I don't know. Maybe the grass is always greener, and perhaps we're often impressed by people overseas, and mine perhaps is a different response.
Let's go back for a moment to your field of study and ask you this. If you took a look at the botany studies in Science or in any of the great academic journals, which have turned out to be not right, is there any flaw in the way in which botanists are trained that creates outcomes that are not always, that are filled with danger?
Boy, that's an interesting question. I think that probably botany, this is probably true of many scientific disciplines, sort of suffers from a certain insularity,
mm-hmm.
perhaps. And But I have tremendous faith in the scientific process, and I think that even when, indeed, sort of fallacious results are published, that over time, if the work is interesting enough, other scientists are going to come along and actually repeat those experiments, or perhaps sort of stumble upon that work and in a less direct fashion, and the truth will out. I mean, this is the wonderful thing about the scientific process relative to other. Modes of human inquiry that I think because of the competitive aspect of all scientific work, we are an edging perhaps slowly towards an ever clearer picture of reality.
Here's an exam question. Who in botany is as Freud was to psychiatry?
Who in botany? This is actually a difficult question for me because since I study fungi, I'm not really a botanist. I mean, botanists study plants.
But you're a biologist.
I'm a biologist, certainly. So you're looking for who might be
yes.
sort of the Sigmund Freud of biology.
Okay, that's a good question.
Well, I would say, I mean, I've got a lot of time for, yeah, as do many people, very magnanimous of me, isn't it? Someone like Richard Dawkins, somebody that's really popularized the science of evolutionary biology. I think he's changed the way that thousands and thousands of people actually have viewed their lives and the natural world. And these are very, very important individuals, I believe. And their influence actually goes way beyond the sort of specialist fields in which they work.
So if I say the word Darwin to you, what do you say back?
I would say that Charles Darwin was a very important individual.
But was it a catalyst or not? And why was
yes,
he
Yes, absolutely. I mean Darwin was the Darwin's work, the publication of The Origin of Species or On the Origin of Species in 1859. I mean this is really the beginning of modern biology.
In science, is somebody like Darwin inevitable, or Freud in psychiatry? In other words, is it possible, if he didn't do what he did, we would still not have enjoyed this? Or was it going to happen no matter what?
Well, we know that in Darwin's case, we absolutely know that it was going to happen.
Because it was another set of papers, yeah.
Because we had, Wallace sure. At the same time actually deriving the same principles, the same truths. And so we do know that this would have happened anyway. And I think that's the case with most examples of scientific breakthroughs, that, it's a case of being in the right place at the right time, working within a particular milieu with other colleagues. And I think there is an inevitability to a great deal of scientific discovery.
We are talking to Dr. Nicholas Money, a Western Program Director and Professor of Botany at Miami University in Ohio. So if we had not, out of the Second World War, one of the most productive scientific things that came out of the war were the capture of the German scientists by both the Soviet Union and us. And that, I guess that is where, one wonders about how, if that hadn't happened, whether we would be on the moon right now, whether we would have gotten where we're going. I guess that's the question for the scientists that I'm trying to ask.
Well, I suppose that case could be made. I mean, of course, there were a huge number of scientists that actually escaped Nazi Germany and actually emigrated from Europe before and during the Second World War that played a huge role in American science in the second half of the 20th century.
It was Einstein's contributions is so great that it's inevitable that somebody will disprove what he said. I say that because we have a spate of articles that show us that, maybe this part of what he thought wasn't quite right or that.
Well, I think the emphasis there should be on the word maybe, so that there are a number of... So, for example, we saw some of this flurry of interest a few months ago in the possibility
exactly.
that the speed of light may not actually be a constant, but at the moment the available evidence seems to suggest that indeed we can be confident that the speed of light is constant. So I suppose over time it's possible that some of the ideas derived by Einstein will be overturned or will evolve, but I think that's not the case for the majority of Einstein's work.
My own failure to conceptualize, which is pretty great, a lot of this is that we don't know what infinity is. We just don't know where the outside of knowledge is, because we don't really know how far it all goes. Is that right?
Well, I mean, there are definitely limitations to what we to what humans might understand. I think this comes from the fact that we're a species of African ape that evolved in the Rift Valley of East Africa.
Sure.
A couple of hundred thousand years ago, and there's certain things that perhaps we may never be able to wrestle with, and certainly the concept of infinity seems to me something that the vast majority of humans are never going to be able to have a sort of an intuitive sense of what that means.
So you're the biologist. You just opened up a huge, interesting thing for me, evolution. We think we know where we came from, but do we know where we're going?
I think we can make predictions about where we're going as a species, and my view there would probably be more negative than the view of many of your listeners.
Explain.
Well, I'm a neo-Malthusian. I'm not somebody that is feels particularly positive about the trajectory of human population growth, and over time, I think. I mean, we're already seeing the effects of this unsupportable, unsustainable growth of the human population, and this is being manifested in many, many ways. Not least of which is global climate change, and if I were to come back in 200 years and see humans as a species thriving with modern cities, and I'd be very, very surprised. I don't think we'll get much beyond the next half century.
Do you think there's a sort of an anti-scientific, anti intellectual bias that is growing, particularly in this country, that leads us to have so much deniability about what the scientists are telling us is absolute fact?
I think this is a tremendous problem. And there, actually, I think you have identified a profound difference between British and American society and perhaps even British and American students is the willingness of these countries, these two different countries, to embrace scientific fact.
What leads to that outcome? I mean, what is it in Great Britain that they don't have that we have that leads this, to the doubters?
The tremendous difference, of course, is that Britain and most of Europe, we're dealing with societies that are a lot more secular than our own. And, we have our First Amendment, which is a wonderful thing. I don't want to say but after referring to the Constitution. There is no but. That's period. This is a wonderful thing. Nevertheless, the influence of religion in politics and in education in this country is something that I've always found very dispiriting.
When I keep thinking of what you just said and the dangers, you come back in 100 years. And this morning I was hearing something on the BBC in which they were talking about all the hackers, thousands of hackers, incredibly bright, who could get into any system. And of course, any system includes the systems that set off all of these atomic weapons that are stationed all over the world.
And
just for the hell of it.
Yeah, we're only beginning to understand the degree of the threat posed by cyber warfare. At first sight, it seems, how could we possibly be harmed by computer hackers? And then you just think about this for a few minutes and you realize that we could be harmed by computer hackers in a multitude of different ways.
So your visit in 100 years from now, do you think as a biologist we'll get to the stage where people live to 200 years old?
I think that's very unlikely. I think that's exceedingly unlikely.
Because?
We haven't been able to, at least, we haven't extended the maximum human lifespan much, if at all, since biblical times. What we have been successful in doing is keeping more of us going for longer. So that is one of the wonders of modern medicine. But in terms of really increasing the human lifespan, I don't know where those breakthroughs would come from.
Well, we can replace the organs. We can make synthetic organs. We can make synthetic hearts. We can make synthetic skin. You're the expert, but to me, in the old days they died at 40. Now they're dying at 80. That's double.
We've kept people going. That's right. So as I said, more of us live longer and make it to a ripe old age. But we're not seeing people live. People don't get to live beyond 100 and. I don't know what the oldest person is, don't get to live beyond 115 years. So I think it's very unlikely that we're going to have people. It's also terrifying. I mean, the idea that with where are we at the moment with 7 billion human beings and racing towards probably 9 billion. And the fact that the rate of mortality will decrease.
Well, we haven't seen Malthus, who you cited before.
We haven't yet. That's the thing. That's the thing.
And of course, not in India, not in China, not billions of people, not in Pakistan.
No, not yet. That's true. So maybe I'm just being like Chicken Little. The sky's falling, but I wouldn't bank on it.
Well, I've had a wonderful time with you. Our guest has been Dr. Nicholas Money, Weston Program Director and Professor of Botany at Miami University in Ohio. His most recent book is Mushroom. Dr. Money, you're really on it, as in the money. Thank you so much for joining us. I couldn't help myself.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.
Thank you.